Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Today, we have Dr. Steve Stain, chairman of surgery at Albany Medical Center, past director of the American Board of Surgery, and current chairman of the RRC. He'll be talking to us today about resident education, the role of the RRC, and changes in maintenance of certification. For our dissection of the day, he'll discuss cystic neoplasms of the pancreas. For our random fact of the day, we'll discuss homonyms and heteronyms. For our tips and tricks today, he'll take us through a distal pancreatectomy. But first, our opening shot.
All right, our opening shot today, we're going to focus on cystic neoplasms of the pancreas. Jay, tell us a little bit about the patient demographics that get these.
Sure. On the whole, about 1% of the population has a cyst on the pancreas that's visible by CT. This increases with age, and at autopsy reports, about 24% of the people will show an incidental cyst on the pancreas.
Yeah, it's amazing how much we're starting to see more of these lesions as everybody's getting a CAT scan for various different reasons. So, Kevin, what are most cysts that are seen on the pancreas, though?
So most cysts are benign pseudocysts. Only 10 to 15% are actually primary pancreatic cysts. And of all these cysts, 75% of them are actually found incidentally on imaging.
So, Jay, I got a patient, they come in, they got a CAT scan for back pain or whatever, and they were found to have one of these cystic lesions on their pancreas. What's the traditional workup, again, given the situation that they may be presenting to you with it found incidentally on CAT scan?
Yeah, the first is to look at the protocol for the CT. To really get a good idea or characterization of these cysts, you have to have a pancreas protocol CT with thin slices, or you can go to MRI. And on these, you're looking for the size, the location, if there's loculations, if there's communication with the pancreatic duct, and if there's a solid mass associated with the cyst. From there, you can go to some of your adjunctive measures, like an endoscopic ultrasound, where you can look for septations, the wall characteristics, any adjacent masses, and you can get fluid analysis.
Yeah, that's a critical portion of it, of that analysis. So what are they looking for in terms of that fluid analysis? We'll go into that a little bit as we go into the different types of there. But in general, there's some talk, Kevin, about a genetic test. What is that all about?
Yeah, they can actually, patients with these pancreatic or cysts, they can do a genetic test for KRAS, and there's actually other genetic tests to identify if these lesions are high risk of becoming malignancies.
There's certain risk factors that are out there, Jason, that are higher risk of malignancy. What are those?
Yeah, in general, on imaging, if there's a thick wall, if they have septations, any intramural nodules or calcifications.
So now we're going to focus on the differential itself, and we're going to take and just give us some few high points about each of these different ones. We're going to start off with not a true cystic neoplasm, but the pseudocyst, since we mentioned that. Kevin, tell me a little bit about the pseudocyst.
Right. So the pseudocyst is the most common cyst overall found in the pancreas. These are more common in men and generally occur after pancreatitis. So a patient that's had pancreatitis in their history, this is once you want to have this high on your differential. These can be evenly distributed throughout the pancreas, and they have no malignant potential.
Jay, how do we look at these patients? They're going to go along the line, and what does their fluid demonstrate? And typically on imaging, what do you see?
Sure. If you were to sample the fluid of a pseudocyst, you would see macrophages, you'd see no mucin, which is important. You would see elevated amylase levels and a low CEA. On imaging, they're generally unilocular with no internal septa and can have a thin or thick wall and may or may not have calcifications.
Treatment for these, Kevin?
Right. So generally, you observe these unless they're symptomatic or they stay greater than 6 centimeters for a long period of time. And at that point, you can do a cyst gastrostomy or a cyst jejunostomy.
Yeah, there's also some more endoscopic techniques that the GI doctor will be able to do, go down with a scope, and especially for those that are abutting the posterior wall of the stomach, they can open that area and just do this all endoscopically. And next one we're going to focus on is a serocyst adenoma. Jay, a little bit about that one?
Yeah, more common. These are more common in your middle-aged females. They're generally located in the body or the tail of the pancreas, and rarely are they malignant.
On imaging, what are they? Are their classic characteristics?
So these are generally small, They're multiloculated with a honeycomb pattern, and they have a central stellate scar.
Yeah, it's always important to look for those keywords, the central stellate scar being cirrus cystadenoma. So fluid on those, Jay?
You sampled the fluid on a cystadenoma, low amylase, low CEA.
And treatment for those?
In general, if you're confident that it's a serious cystadenoma, you can observe these. You resect if they're symptomatic or if they cannot be differentiated from a malignant cyst.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good point that we need to make sure we emphasize is the fact that, you know, a lot of these recommendations regarding management are with the caveat that you're looking at the patient in front of you, and what you have to do is say, is it symptomatic? Is it going away? Can we really truly tell how good is our sample? How good is our CT scan? And that's obviously individual results may vary. So on to the next one, Kevin. Mucinous cystic neoplasms.
Yeah, so these ones are the ones we're most concerned about. They are found in middle-aged females, most commonly in the body or tail. And they have a high or moderate to high malignant potential.
And imaging, Jay?
These tend to be larger, greater than 2 centimeters. They have an orange fruit appearance, which means they may have peripheral calcifications and be uni or multi-loculated.
I sample the fluid, Kevin.
So these have a classic mucin in their fluid. And the mucin actually has an ovarian stroma appearance that is pathognomonic. And then the CEA will be moderate to high, and the amylase can vary.
Treatment, Jay?
You want to resect these due to their significant malignant potential.
Yeah, and the type of resection obviously depends on where it is in terms of the pancreas itself. And so next one is your IPMN. Kevin?
So the IPMNs are generally found in elderly men with a history of pancreatitis. These can be found in the head of the pancreas and can actually extend throughout because it actually dilates the duct, but the general disease process is normally in the head of the pancreas.
Imaging?
Yeah, on imaging, you'll see, if it involves the main duct, you'll see ductal dilation and possible ductal communication. Oftentimes, you'll see mural nodes. And on ERCP, classically, you get that fish mouth appearance of the ampulla. And sometimes you'll get a gush of mucin material out of the ampulla on ERCP.
Yeah, that's pretty classic. Your gastroenterologist tells you when they cannulate the duct, boom, you get that spray of mucin right at the scope. So fluid in this one, Kev?
So it's a little more nonspecific, kind of similar to the mucinous neoplasms. It's a colorless, thick fluid, has extracellular mucin. The mucin can have epithelial cells with papillary projections, and the CEA and amylase are generally elevated.
Jay, treatment for these?
Treatment for these really kind of involves a conversation with the patient. You need to establish their malignant potential, and this is going to depend on whether the main duct is involved or not. For branch duct IPMNs, they have a lower malignant potential, and typically you'll look at the size of these. You'll look at those greater than 3 centimeters have a higher chance of being malignant, and the main duct have a rather significant chance of being malignant. So you really want to have a conversation with the patient and see what their level of comfort in dealing with these are. You can also sample the fluid and look at the CEA levels to help you make that decision.
So again, if we go overall and just take a step back and just kind of take home points, serous, resective, symptomatic, or if you can't differentiate between the malignant cyst or if it's large in size or increase in rapid growth, mucinous, tend to be younger females, resect, secondary to their high risk, if invasive or if it's in situ as well, and then IPMNs. We talked a little bit about the point of differentiating between whether it's a main duct or whether it's a branch duct.
Right.
In general, what are the characteristics, Kevin, of those that we can more commonly safely observe?
So the lesions that are clearly cystic and they don't have any of the concerning radiologic features with the internal septa or the calcifications, and then you also want to have a fluid sample that shows a low CEA.
Yeah, so it's no malignant features and no in a low CA. And again, that goes into ensuring that the patient is comfortable with that, that they're not symptomatic and it's not changing or having any other risk factors that are more apt to push you to surgery. So we're going to get into this a little bit more with Dr. Stain later in the podcast. And this ends our opening shot. So our random fact of the day today is going to talk about one of the things in the English language. So we have synonyms, we got anonyms, we have certain things. Jay, what's a heteronym? Do you know?
No idea.
Well, a heteronym is a type of homograph. Do you know what a homograph is?
Nope.
Well, a homograph is two or more words that are spelled the same but not necessarily pronounced the same, and they have different meanings and origins. Now, a heteronym is a word that's written identically but has different pronunciation and meaning. In other words, they are homographs that are not homophones. They are words, again, that are spelled the same but differ in meaning and pronunciation. So all heteronyms, I know, by the way, I'm making this clear as mud, but all heteronyms are also homographs, but not all homographs are heteronyms. So many heteronyms are similar in meaning, especially related to the noun and the verb, but they're spelled the same but pronounced differently, while others are wholly unrelated. So I'm going to give you an example of this. So there's a couple of words out there in the English language that have completely different meanings if you simply capitalize the first letter. Dramatic pause for effect. Jay, can you name me any of those?
So you mean like, for instance, like polish and Polish?
Exactly. By simply capitalizing the letter P, you have a completely different word. Can you think of any others?
Wait, I know one.
Yeah.
Lima and Lima.
Kevin, you've been looking either Googling behind my back or doing whatever, but exactly. One of them's a bean and the other one is in Peru. So there's actually a fair amount of these, and not too surprising that in many cases, one is the name of a town or a type of people, but you have, for example, you have Job and Job. Job from the Bible, or Job from the Bible, and Job meaning your task or employment. You also have different ones, Rainier or Rainier. Depending on how you do it. One's a day here in Washington, the other one is a mountain. You can also have worms, verms being lowercase, plural is a capitalized, it's a city in southwest Germany, and then the other one being the plural of worms. So again, capitalizing again, heteronyms and homographs. Simple as mud. We are absolutely pleased to have Dr. Stephen Stain here, who is the Henry and Sally Schaefer Chair, Department of Surgery at Albany Medical Center, and he's also the current chair at the of the RRC. Dr. Stain, welcome to Behind the Knife, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sir, for those who are not as familiar with your background, could you briefly just kind of tell us a little bit where you're from, kind of where you grew up, and then where you trained to lead you to the point at Albany right now?
Certainly. So I grew up in Fresno, California, and I guess in my recent, I was able to be the president of the Western Surgical Association last year, and I guess as part of my presidential address, I say that I'm the product of a public education, went to high school, grade school, high school, college, medical school, at residency, all in public institutions. So I went to college, medical school, University of California in Irvine. I'm very proud to have trained at L.A. County, USC Medical Center. At the time I was a resident, they developed a private hospital, but most of my training was at the county hospital, although we had some rotations at public hospitals. Then I, in the last year of, I guess, after my general surgery residency, I did a kind of interesting year where I ran the ICU and ran the breast service, and that sort of made me a general surgeon. I was fortunate in the last year you could grandfather into critical care fellowship. This was before we had a ACDB approved fellowship. I was able to grandfather into critical care, and I've taken that recertification, I guess, three times, so I'm still recertified. And then for a very interesting set of circumstances, my chief at the time was a person named Arthur Donovan, who is good friends with one of the leading liver surgeons in the world, Leslie Bloomgard, so I got to spend a year in Bloomgard, Switzerland, working with Dr. Bloomgard, or Professor Bloomgard, as we called him, in his last year before he transitioned to Memorial Sloan Kettering. After that, I came back to USC, was on the faculty for 11 years, and, for a while ran the patobiliary service division, and then became program director at Huntington Memorial Hospital, a community hospital experience. I was quite valuable, and then in 2000, I was recruited to be the chair of surgery at Meharry Medical College in Nashville, Tennessee, and in that role, I ran the rotation for the Vanderbilt surgical residents for 6 years at Nashville General Hospital, and I participated in the NCI-funded U54 cancer grant, running the clinical core for Meharry and also the epidemiology biostat core. In November of 2005, I came to Albany Medical College, which is one of the few private medical schools without a undergraduate campus, which has been a great experience for me in building the department.
You know, I wanted to ask you a little bit about two of those points. And the first one is your year in Switzerland. How did you find that year in terms of not only training, but maybe differences in philosophy or differences in patient care? And do you think that transcended well or just really adapted you? What are things that you liked and what are things that maybe you look back that were more difficult to be able to deal with?
Well, the first thing, I guess, relative to you, Scott. So I was there during the first Gulf War. And, you know, I had not thought of myself as a very patriotic person, but didn't take the bus back and forth. And I met a Marine on the bus who invited me to Thanksgiving dinner at the embassy in Bern, Switzerland. And that was an incredible experience and, you know, learned a lot, a little bit about the military and the discipline that they have to guard an embassy. And professionally, Professor Blumgart was a South African Jew who left because of persecution, actually, in South Africa, trained in Scotland, and was in became famous in Hammersmith Hospital in England. He recruited fellows from all over the world, so he had fellows from... I followed Jeff Matthews from University of Chicago. There was friends from Leicester, England now, Ashley Dennison, Guy Mattern from Australia. So after my training, I've been able to go visit them in their institutions and maintain those friendships internationally. I think that the healthcare system, although they had socialized medicine where everyone was insured through the government, there really were three tiers of training. If you had what we would call Medicaid, the resident did your operation. If you had what we call Medicare, typically the Oberarzt or the fellow would do your operation, and the Professor Blumgart did the bigger operations, all the liver operations. And it was different because, you know, I'd been trained at L.A. County where the residents did most of the operations. And so I never thought I would learn by watching. But when I came back to California, I had the stamp of being a liver surgeon and was able to employ what I had watched, you know, sometimes watching the master do operations, you know, artfully, and sometimes when he got in trouble, how he got out of trouble. So I learned a lot of that experience, both culturally and operatively.
Well, that's a perfect transition, sir. We're hoping to hear a little bit about your experience as the chair of the RRC, and if you could just break down a little bit on exactly what the RRC does.
So I'll back up a bit, because before I became chair of the RRC, I was chair of the American Board of Surgery, which was probably the most professionally satisfying experience I've had, where, you know, there's 34 or 35 people, and, you know, everyone, although I was a representative from the Western Surgical, you sort of represent all of surgery, you check your label at the door. And that, I guess, taught me to interact with people all over the country who are, you know, luminaries in their field, and we struggled with lots of big issues, the future of surgery. I think we, you know, the day-to-day work was writing exams, and because at the time I was one of the few critical care certified people, I got put on the critical care test writing committee. So I wrote exam questions for 7 years on the exam committee. And then after that, I finished my board stint, which was 8 years. Then I got selected. I was actually nominated by the college to be in the RRC, which is a much smaller group of 14 people. Typically, we look at it as the board sets the standards for individual certification. Working with the RRC, the board comes up with criteria for program evaluation and certification. So the RRC is... has delegated authority from the ACGME, and the members of the RRC for surgery come from the American College of Surgeons, the AMA, and the American Board of Surgery. So a number of people, such as me, have been fortunate to transition after time on the board to go on to the RRC, and we look at all the programs in the country for general surgery, vascular surgery, surgical critical care, now surgical oncology, and if we have some of, overhand. And I think that we, you know, write the program requirements for what programs have to do, and I think have a responsibility for making sure that programs meet the standards that are agreed upon to train residents. And that's been an important responsibility.
So, kind of tying into that same thing, in 2012, the New England Journal of Medicine published a special report talking about the NEXT accreditation system. Can you kind of touch a little bit briefly on that and the differences in accreditation between the old and new system, and kind of what changes do you think are on the horizon, or maybe what you're most proud of, or what you see as difficulties in this and under this type of guise?
Well, the NEXT accreditation system comes down to people being in a continuous or annual evaluation. So an example is our meeting in February, we had to evaluate 550 programs. We didn't look in depth at 550 programs, but the RRC agreed upon what were the high-value measures of a program's performance. And they're the things you might think would be important. Do the residents pass their boards? Do the residents do enough cases? Duty hours are also important. So we take a look at duty hours, and we sort of take an initial look at all programs if they have outliers. I left out the resident survey as another important factor. So if residents are unhappy, some interesting data which hasn't been published yet, I don't believe, but it's been looked at first for the Phase 1 NEXT accreditation system programs, which are in medicine and primary care programs, but there was an amazing correlation between resident survey results and other things wrong in the program, both board pass rate, duty hour violations, and operative volume. So although I didn't believe how important the resident survey would be, but it's one of the most important markers, global markers, of how a program is doing in training residents.
So sir, can I interrupt you right now to touch on that? One of the things that comes up oftentimes is how to differentiate between the resident who's just, he's the outlier in the program, the whiner, the complainer, or whatever, the one who's the Jose Canseco, who's speaking out the truth, but he's the only one to say it, you know, to use a baseball analogy. How do you go about differentiating between those two? Is it clear? Is it tough?
They use frequencies. So, you know, so they'd like to get 90% of the residents to respond to the resident survey. So, you know, there are national benchmarks, for example, I'm guessing, but it's about, you know, 5% of the residents in the country say they violate the 80-hour work week.
Mm-hmm.
So if a resident, has 6 or 7% of the residents complain about that, we don't ignore, but we sort of put it in context of other things in the program. But if they have 20%,
yeah,
then it's important. And then when the site visitor comes in and looks at those programs and visits the programs, they randomly select residents to come in and talk to the site visitor. And if there is a belief of the site visitor confirmed by the resident survey that they have duty hour problems or interference with other learners such as fellows, then those are the things that result in citations. And it's not an absolute number of citations that puts you in probation or warning, but it's the high value one. So if you have, I'll pick out two, bad poor board pass rate and something else, the odds are very likely you're going to go on probation.
Right.
And I think the board and the RRC have some accepted pass rate, 65% first-time pass rate for both the written and the oral exam. If you can't do that, it may mean that something is wrong with the program, and we take a much closer look at them.
Mm-hmm. And could you expand a little bit upon, you know, some of the recent new developments suggested by the American Board of Surgery that kind of talks about changing general surgery and restructuring a general surgery to a 4+ or a 1+2 and going from there that would impact subspecialty training?
Well, actually, I talked to Frank Lewis about that today. It's a point of continued evaluation. I think that about 80% of the surgeons in the country do fellowships, and the reasons why that is multifactorial. I think the common wisdom is they do it because they're not well trained. I'm not sure if I buy that. I think that, you know, it could be equally important. They do it because they want to take better care of their patients. I think that, you know, a colorectal surgeon, for example, is probably better than the average general surgeon who has not had additional training in doing some of the more complex types of colorectal surgery. Jim Fleshman, who's on the board with me when I was on the when we were on the board together, used to say that they spend the initial part of their fellowship training in colorectal teaching residents stuff they should have done in general surgery. So, for example, a general surgeon, in my opinion, should be able to do a lap colon, or if they finish, when they finish. And Albany is a relatively moderate-sized town, but I would say most of the colons are done by colorectal surgeons here. Mm-hmm. A good general surgeon who is well trained should be able to do a, you know, a lap right colon, or maybe even a lap sigmoid. But I think a colorectal surgeon, I'm convinced from what I've seen both in data and experience, is much more adept at doing a low anterior or a lap low anterior. So in my hospital, though I think I'm a pretty good general surgeon, I don't do elective colon surgery. Mm-hmm. If I'm on call, I think I'm capable of, you know, the rare patient who needs an emergency colectomy for a, you know, a volvulus or a perf sigmoid, a free perf, I can do that operation. But if they just have diverticulitis, for example, can be treated non-operatively for initially, I transfer them to the colorectal surgeon the next morning. And I think that is something which, you know, the general surgeons of 25 years ago would say you should be able to take that operation and do it as well as a subspecialist. But most of us, myself included, had not had the broad amount of training, you know, let's say in endocrine surgery or in complex rectal surgery. I mean, I haven't done an esophagus I assisted with one at 15 years ago, but it's not something I think would be the best operation for a patient if I did an esophagectomy. There are people who have done either by their specific training or their experience. So if you were a general surgeon that's been doing esophagectomies for 25 years, you can probably do it well. But if you're like me, who's done one in 15 years, it's probably not the best outcome for the patient.
You know, I think it's pretty fascinating with the dual hats that you've worn with the American Board of Surgery Board of Directors as well as the RC. And so kind of with that insight, a couple of questions, I guess, pertaining to either which side of the fence you look on. But how then do you feel you have a general surgeon who doesn't do any of that and he sits for his boards and says, I got it. We never did it. I don't do it. I just do bread and butter general surgery. And do I need to know and describe how to do a hepatectomy or something that I'll, or an esophagectomy that I'm never going to do? I'm going to send to all of these ones. How do you balance that fund of knowledge with the fact that they're maybe never going to do it, especially on the research?
So I think they're separate. So for the initial certification, I believe that to be a general surgeon, you need to have a very, very broad knowledge and ability. So mm-hmm. an example is that, on the day of my board certification, oral exam in 1988, I was for 89, mm-hmm. I knew how to do a parotidectomy. Mm-hmm. I have not done a parotidectomy. I don't think I will ever do a parotidectomy. So there's been a change in the board exam where they've, you know, kind of driven by score. Mm-hmm. They've tried to go to more bread and butter surgery clinical scenarios, mm-hmm. which I think is the board's decision. I think it may expose the fact that, you know, residents may do a number of operations. Some data that I've seen about the comparison of complex operations now versus 20 years ago, residents do actually more complex operations. However, they're not actually seeing the patient, you know, preoperatively deciding who has an operation. My residents get lots of clinical operations they do, but having the in-depth knowledge to manage complex clinical problems, I think that, so I believe that you should be prepared on your initial certification to manage a broad amount of surgical conditions, because even if you're a colorectal surgeon, you may take general surgery call, or if you're a minimally invasive surgeon, you may have to deal with a breast abscess.
Right.
Eva Singletary wrote a great editorial about 10 years ago in the Surgical Oncology Journal about why don't we have modular recertification, which would mean, you know, the 200 questions you get for your recertification exam, why not have 150 of them be about breast and 50 being about general surgery? Mm-hmm. The board decided not to do that. I voted that we should do it because it was more practical to how we actually practice. So now, if I got a patient who had a, you know, ME and one, not something I see every day, you know, I'd go look in a book. I'd be in favor of open book exams. Mm-hmm. The board pass rate for subspecialists is higher than that for general surgeons.
Mm-hmm.
The highest is in pediatric surgeons who recertify in general surgery. They're smart people who are kind of anal retentive, who will go out and study for it. But I think that we should consider transitioning the maintenance of certification exam. The statisticians told us it would not be as statistically valid an exam for general surgery if we did modular. I think we would give up some statistical validity, but I think it would be more practical and it would be more relevant to how surgeons practice. I also served for, four or five years on the American Board of Medical Specialty Maintenance and Certification mm-hmm. Committee, and we argued that, and they did some pilots with some open book exams. There's some concern about people who are might not be honest.
Mm-hmm. But,
you know, when I recertified, so I recertified in general surgery, I think a year or two ago, and, you know, I did CSAP, you know.
Right.
I would like to think that I could walk in and pass that exam without studying at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think I could. But the process of preparing for it made me relearn things that I used to know that I don't do every day.
Right.
So I think the value of recertification is in the preparation as much as it is in for the exam. And, you know, I'm about a 25-year recertification person now. But if you look at the 30-year people versus the 10-year people, the board failure rate goes up the longer you're out from your training.
Right.
And I think there are, you know, public policy reasons why we should have a bar that people need to jump over to continue to say they're board certified.
Yeah, I did CSEP as well for my general surgery, as well as I got my colorectal research coming up in a month. But, that leads me to my next question. I know you can't speak for the board, but can you talk a little bit about kind of what's going on with the kind of the pushback, especially against maintenance of certification, that the internal medicine world is recently going through, and some of the, obviously that's been even hit the lay press.
So the medicine board, ABIM, I think made too onerous a requirements for their maintenance certification. You know, they had to do a patient safety module, which is good to do. But mm-hmm. they charge people, you know, $300 or $400 to do it.
Mm-hmm.
They had to do so many things every year, it became a great burden on their diplomates. For surgery, which is, believe it or not, one of the least expensive costs at about $1,000 for recertification, the four components, number one and three, I think in my mind are no-brainers. I wrote this on one of those communities that, you know, number one is you need to have a license to practice medicine. That's not too hard. Number three, part three, is you need to recertify every 10 years.
Right.
The problems come in parts two and four. Parts two require, I think it's 100 hours or 60 hours of CME every 3 years. I think it's 100 hours and 60 must be part, you know, category one of CME. And, you know, because you and I go to lots of meetings, we get a lot of CME.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm reading constantly on my computer all day, you know.
Right.
I'm reviewing an article. I look at Medscape. So I think that bar for people like us who I think are dedicated to trying to take better care of patients, who will look up something they don't know, it probably seems to be pretty easy, but if you're a private practitioner in rural Kansas, it may be hard to get those CME. And I think that there's something that could be done to better educate surgeons. What are the, you know, the opportunities that you can do? You know, Jax has questions. You can see, so you can do it, but it does take time. But I think that's something that, if I were to advise the board, that I think they could probably still have something that has validity, but it's a little less onerous. Part four, which most of the people have trouble with, is the assessment of your practice. And I chaired the MOC committee for the board for a while, and that committee, we tried to make it significant, but a low bar to jump over, such as participation in any quality improvement program. So if your hospital does NISQIP, you're automatically, your hospital does, you know, PQRS, if your hospital does UNOS certification, any of those things. And I think the participation, which makes you look at your own results and do self-reflection, is the value.
Right.
I think that what many people do, and I've talked to David Hoyt about this, the surgeon-specific registry, which is something which some people do, but that's pretty onerous, keeping track of every case, looking at your complications. I'm more in favor of the fact that, the you know, if you participate in M&M conference and you look at your own results and you have leaks all the time, you, as a surgeon, you're kind of, you know, been trained and geared to self-improve.
Right.
I think that self-evaluation is the important part in how we can educate physicians, surgeons, to understand that you don't have to pick the hardest thing to do that self-evaluation. So the board, American Board of Surgery, has maintained, against some pressure from others, that participation in a self-improvement activity has value and is something that surgeons, by participating, will self-correct if they find that they're beyond, you know, standard deviation of what others are doing.
Mm-hmm. Great. Sir, as a resident, we hear a lot of different things about the 80-hour work week and different rumors, and we see different programs practicing different things. Is the 80-hour work week dead? And what are the greatest challenges facing surgical residencies in the next 10 years?
Well, the 80-hour work week, I don't think it's been what has hurt surgery. And a lot of people believe that the 80-hour work week is bad for training. I think that we should be able to train residents at 80 hours. The problem has been, or is, in my opinion, that the practice of surgery has changed. Most of my residents meet the patient the morning of surgery because they operate, you know, 4.5 days a week, and they're in clinic a half day a week. So I think there's medicine's very, you know, much higher paced. Things happen quicker. I give grand rounds of, you know, a fair bit of places, and probably 3 or 4 years ago, I was at the University of Mississippi, and they had a float rotation for chief residents. And I thought that was the craziest thing that I could ever hear. But when I talked to our residents, they thought it would be a good idea. So we tried. So we actually have a float system where for 2 months a year, our chief residents do night float. And so they're on from 6 p.m. till 7 or 8 a.m. the next day. They're awake and they want to operate. So rather than waiting for gallbladders to be done the next day, we do them that night. Mm-hmm. And we have attendings in-house. And I think what it does for when they're on the elective service, the other 10 months, they never miss cases because they're post-call.
Do you have an acute care service?
We do. So they take trauma call and do all the emergency general surgery.
Okay.
So I think that's a change that the 80-hour week gets blamed for, but I think it's probably better for patient care. I don't think it hurts resident education. A lot of the time when in my generation we were in the hospital, we were waiting for something to happen. I think now when residents are in the hospital at night, they're more likely to be doing something than just waiting.
Have you looked at your numbers and seen, have you had either a drop-off in those chief residents in terms of complexity of cases or diversity of cases? I know that's been one of the arguments against that float system.
Well, the same cases get done. They're just done in different months. So,
yeah.
So granted, those 2 months you're doing less complex cases, but you know,
right.
you may be there for the trauma cases. But as you know, there's a lot of sitting around for trauma waiting for complicated cases.
Right.
But you never miss the elective low anterior mm-hmm. resection or the distal pancreatectomy. And I think that overall, my residents love it.
Yeah.
So I think it's something which, you know, and I think that it's easy to blame the 80-hour week for how our residents are not as good as they were before. I gave grand rounds about 8 or 9 years ago at Hopkins, and I asked the question, the title is it time to change hall study and training? And believe it or not, John Cameron studied before to learn what hall, I mean, he knows by top of his head, but he went and read the Halstedian principles of training. And mm-hmm. when I got up there, I had a slide that I said, is the resident this year, you know, finishes in 2005 as good as the resident who finished 20 years before? At the end of it, Cameron got up and said, they're better. He said, they're, you know, they have information on their, you know, on their smartphone, you know, they're better, well read, and they're better read. They, know basic science better. So, you know, the Hopkins residents were shocked that Cameron would say that. But I think we have faulty memory of what it was like 25 years ago. I think that the residents at good programs get lots of operative experience. What they lack, though, is autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to do operations by myself.
Right.
Had a professor down the hall who I could ask if I had problems. But for a simple operation, I did it by myself.
Right.
And then in my junior faculty time, the attendings would, you know, we would come in and sign the sheet. But now, because of the pressures of getting through cases, the operative time is very valuable. The residents, you know, almost have too much supervision. One of the things the board and the RRC are talking about, or at least the board's talking about, how we can build more autonomy into the training. And I think some of the ideas, none of which are agreed upon, is, we have some non-accredited fellowships like MIS, for example, and we let them take general surgery call. We're there if there's a faculty member at home if they need something, but they can take general surgery call or trauma call. These are board-eligible surgeons still, you know, in a training program, but they've already finished 5 years of surgery. I think that's what happens during fellowship. As you work with somebody for a whole year or two, you become more comfortable with what they can do by themselves. And
right.
And they're better technically, so they can get cases started or finished, and you come in for less of the operation as they get more senior. So I think one of the challenges we have is to build more autonomy into training, still protecting the public and making sure they get a good operation.
Switch gears now into a segment that's called the dissection of the day. And this is where we delve a little bit more into kind of a focus topic. And the topic that we're going to discuss is the cystic neoplasms of the pancreas. So, Kevin?
Yes, sir. So today, sir, we're going to talk about, like Dr. Steele said, the cystic neoplasm. So if you have a patient referred to you for an incidental finding of a couple centimeter cystic neoplasm on the pancreas, what would your standard imaging workup be? And how would you decide whether to operate on this patient?
Well, I think the standard workup now, you know, cross-sectional imaging, CT or MRI, I'm sort of probably a little more old-fashioned. I prefer CT, although MRI is an equivalent modality. I think EUS, endoscopic ultrasound, gives you the best method of sampling it. So I think that in endoscopic ultrasound is an appropriate next step. And a biopsy. And if, you know, if the fluid has, elevated CEA or has mucin, then I think it's much more likely to get, require more therapy. Size is important. I think the criteria of the SENDAI criteria that if it's greater than 3 centimeters or, involves the main duct, it probably needs to have a resection. I would say that, from what I read and what I do, I'm probably on the conservative side. I have a couple of patients who are in their late 70s with head lesions that are, you know, 2.5 centimeters, and I've followed them for a few months or years, and fortunately they've not expanded. So I think location is important. I'm more likely to follow a head lesion than a tail lesion, but I think that... there's increasing data coming out that these lesions can be followed if they have, you know, no mucin, it's less than 3 centimeters, and the patient's a relatively high operative risk. Following them for a while to see the progression is worthwhile.
Especially if you're going to follow these patients, are you biopsying all of these patients, or are you more apt to biopsy if you're apt to following them, or if it's got other concerning things, or is that a pretty standard part of your algorithm to biopsy?
Yeah, I think biopsy is part of my algorithm because you don't want to miss something.
And right.
I realize that they can be followed with just cross, you know, sectional imaging, but I think I'm much more comfortable following somebody mm-hmm. if I have no adverse data, you know, no mucin, no CEA, and I think there's, you know, no septation. I'm much more likely to follow patients. So I would probably err on getting more data to make me more comfortable with following the patient.
Sir, quickly to touch on the radiology imaging, what would make you concerned just on imaging with the CT or the endoscopic ultrasound of a malignant process other than size?
I think if it involves the main duct, to be more concerned. I think that if so, I think endoscopic ultrasounds can give you some of that. I think that if there's if it's not purely cystic, there's some solid components, I'd be much, much more concerned. So I think that, you know, and also the age of the patient and their medical comorbidities, mm-hmm. I think that's probably most important. You know, a young 40-year-old with a tail lesion that's 2.8 centimeters, they're very nervous about it, they're very anxious about it, and it's a much less morbid operation, and I would probably lean more towards operation.
So we're going to walk through a little bit of this in our tips and tricks segments in terms of the operative management and doing a lap distal pancreatectomy. But closing up the dissection of the day, how do you decide how to follow these patients then, with surgery, without surgery, and kind of long-term outcomes of these patients? Are you under a protocol if it's malignant, margins, stuff like that? What are you doing for surveillance?
I think there's some data that the IPMNs may be multifocal. So I think if they get resected, we follow them with serial imaging for, you know, every 3 months for the first year, then every 6 months for the next year, and then every year after that. I think for margins, we accept a clear margin for these, not trying to get a centimeter or two. If it's a clear margin, we consider that a clear margin and don't do anything more. One of our surgeons, Ankesh Nigam, has been using intraoperative ultrasound to look for other lesions, and he's found other lesions that he's included as a resection if it's in the tail. Not so much chasing lesions in the head by doing Whipples if he's not sure the malignant potential of the tumor.
How do you, if you're doing a distal panc, how do you deal with the duct? Do you oversew it? Do you use a certain load, stapler? What are you using? How are you doing that operation?
I do a staple, usually a blue load, and then I always oversew it.
Mm-hmm.
Usually a locking purline. I run it up with a horizontal mattress and then baseball it back.
Do you leave drains on these?
Always.
Okay.
Always.
Okay, we're going to switch to our last segment now, and this is the tips and tricks segments. It's where we get helpful hints from our experts to get us out of those sticky situations. So, sir, I got an operation for you. You're doing a open distal pancreatectomy, and First question is, how do you find the right planes? How do you ensure you kind of get in that avascular plane to avoid damage to the splenic vein?
So, if it's a distal pancreatectomy and I'm going to try and preserve the spleen, which if there's a chance of malignancy or a reasonable chance, you know, I wouldn't work too hard. I think for adults, the risk of post-splenectomy sepsis is not great.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was something that I was unsure of whether it was cancer or not, I'd first get in the lesser sac. And once I was in the lesser sac, I'd see the pancreas try and extend to see the pancreas and usually put a Deaver or something under the stomach to lift it up and see the capsule of the pancreas on the underside of the pancreas. I would incise the peritoneal covering of the pancreas and lift up the pancreas superiorly to come to where I'm going to find the splenic vein. Then start medially, extend laterally towards the hilum of the spleen, and get to the end of the pancreas, and then take it typically from lateral to medial. That can get bloody at times, but if you're in the right plane, that usually lifts up pretty easily.
Are you using energy here? Are you using electrocautery, or what are you using?
I use snow for that. I know other people do. I use scissors, and sharp dissection.
Okay. And how do you handle those little bleeders in those cases?
I stick time with 306.
Okay. So now you're coming across from a lateral to medial. What's the typical medial boundary that you're using?
I go up to the junction of the portal vein and the SMV. I mean, if you know what's really in the tail, you can take less. But I think that's that amount of resection, in my experience, you don't have to worry about. Preserve the head, the onset process, or not diabetic. So a standard resection would be, if I can feel it to get beyond it, I would know from the CT scan where it's supposed to be. And it's usually, if I'm doing a distal, if it's going to be to the left of the SMV.
If you're doing an end block resection with the spleen, are you? What's your order? What's your mobilization order in terms of taking these out? Are you taking down the splenic attachments first and then having sure that's all free, or what do you do?
So my background is a trauma surgeon, so I do it as a trauma splenectomy. I get behind the spleen. I bring it all up into the wound. You make the spleen a midline organ and then take down the short gastrics. I usually tie those with Kelly's or Payon's, tie them off, sometimes over so the gray curvature of the stomach, and I bring it all into the center of the wound so I can see, and then take it from behind.
Now, are you taking the artery and the vein separately, or are you using one staple fire across with everything, especially if you're doing that distal splenic? How are you dealing with the vessels?
I know people staple those, but I always usually double tie them first, getting around with clamps, then do a single tie, and then do a stick tie afterwards.
Okay, so for our trainees out there, let's just move the scenario and say that you're doing a distal splenic-sparing pancreatectomy, distal pang. You get a little bit of splenic capsular bleeding. Take us through your algorithm of how you go about trying to make that go away and without getting into further problems.
So first, just manual pressure with a gauze. While I'm holding pressure with the gauze and usually giving it a minute or two to see if it stops by itself, I'd ask the nurse to get some Surgicel up. That's probably where I would start with Surgicel. If that didn't work, I'd probably get the argon beam coagulator and use that next. I probably would not, you know, if I was doing a distal pancreatectomy and there was bleeding that would require me to do, you know, some sort of complicated repair of either sutures, I would probably err on just taking the spleen out and not having to worry about it.
Do you ever use any of the adjunct topicals, Fibrillar, or any of those other ones that are out there on the market, or the sprays?
Some gel foam that's been soaked in some of the glue, but I'm probably more apt to take it off. I want to be sure that post-op bleeding is not going to be a problem. So if I'm doing it for a tumor, I would have told the patient that there's a good chance that they may lose their spleen, and I would not work too hard to try and save a spleen. If it's a trauma patient, a young healthy trauma patient, I might work to save the spleen. But if doing something where I think there's likely to be a cancer, I would probably remove the spleen most of the time if there's any question about bleeding.
And then if you're doing an end block resection, do you have anything specific of how you handle the short gastrics, or are you leaving those alone, let them retract, over sewing them?
Oh, no, I take them with clamps, and then typically I would over sew the greater curvature of the stomach with I would take them with clamps and then tie them with a 2 or 3-0 soak, and then I would often just, you know, imbricate the greater curvature over the short gases with Rios silks.
Great. Those are fantastic tips. Thanks, sir. Okay. Well, with every one of our guests, sir, we always wind up with our final five. These are five quick questions that allow us, they're all quick hitters to allow the listeners to get to know you a little bit better. So, Kevin, number one.
Yes, sir. So if you were to open your iTunes library right now on your phone, what would you have been playing last? And do you play music in the operating room?
I usually don't pick the music in the operating room, but I like music to be played. Nothing, you know, sort of pop music, what they usually gets played. The last thing I listened to as I was on the plane, I listened to some Bruno Mars.
So Britney Spears in the operating room. Fantastic. Number two. Tell us a hidden talent or a passion or some sort of an interest that you have you'd like to do outside of the operating room.
I like to play golf. I'm not too good at it, but I've been playing since I was 15. Probably one of my favorite things I do every year is my high school. I played on the high school golf team. Mm-hmm. I was never good enough to play in a varsity match, but most of my friends played golf. So every year, my high school friends and I get together to play golf, eight of us. This year, we're going to outside of San Francisco, and it's, you know, about five of the eight will be high school classmates, and a couple will be friends who've come to this every year. So I think my favorite pastime, and probably in the summer, I'll play a couple times a week after work, you know, go out at 6:30 or 7 to play till 8:30, try and get in nine holes. So golf's probably my thing I do outside of work most often.
So a couple of quick sub parts of that question. We need your handicap and then the make model of your irons, putter, and driver, and the degree of the driver. And then finally, what's the coolest course you've ever played?
I have a 10.5 degree tailor-made driver, but more importantly, I got this incredible Fujishima or something like that, this incredible shaft. So I have tailor-made everything. I have the same putter that I had since I was 15. I've gone to other putters, I've come back, but it's a Ping. But I bought probably 2.5-3 years ago, I bought all new tailor-made clubs and the driver, the 10.5 degree. Actually, I went from a stiff to a regular. I couldn't make the stiffs go anymore.
And a rescue wood? Did you get the rescue wood with it?
Oh, yeah. So now it's 3, 4, and 5 are all hybrids.
Yeah.
3, 4, and 5 irons are all hybrids.
Handicap and the coolest course that you've played?
I'm a 15 handicap, 15-6, I think. Probably Torrey Pines. So one of my high school classmates, who was actually a lawyer in San Diego, when I go to San Diego to visit, usually we play Torrey Pines, and we've played it right after they've had the U.S. Open or the local tournament there, and it's an incredibly difficult course to play, but it's probably one of the best times I have. So yeah, I think Torrey Pines would be the coolest place I've played.
The next question is, what is the greatest change in surgery that you've seen in your career?
Probably laparoscopic surgery, minimally invasive surgery. So, I did the first lap chole at LA County. There's a great surgeon, Ed Phillips, who's a LA County graduate, who's chief of general surgery at Cedars-Sinai. He came and took me through the operation. I think that we interviewed minimally invasive surgery fellows today, and I think that, you know, the things that could be done minimally invasively are incredible, and I think the surgeon of 10 years from now or even 5 years from now needs to have, you know, exceptional minimally invasive skills to be able to still stay relevant.
Number four, if you didn't become a surgeon, what would you be doing right now? What other career path?
Well, I was asked, so I trained in LA County at the time there was a cut where you started with 10 people in July and in October 4 people were told they weren't coming back, and I got asked that question by Tom Byrne, and I said to him I would have been a construction worker, although I don't think my back could take it. I used to work summers doing construction work up in Canada, and I think I I like working with my hands. That's what I would have done at the time. As I get older, I'd probably said I'd like to run a restaurant.
Yeah. What kind of food?
I worked my way through high school and college working in steak restaurants. I like steaks. It'd probably be a steak and lobster place.
Okay, sir, the last question. If you could go back in time and tell yourself one piece of advice on your first day of surgical internship, what would you say?
I would say, you know, as hard as surgery is and as surgical training is and as much as it changes you, you can go back to being the person you want to be after you finish your training. I think surgery has the amazing ability to do lots of different things. You can be a basic science researcher and be a surgeon. You can be a busy clinical general surgeon, vascular surgeon, or you could be, run a department. So I think that, as I was an intern, I was so caught up with learning my skills that I probably didn't realize what was in front of me. And I think that, as I talk to my kids now, I hope they go in medicine. I think it's a great field. I hope they go into surgery. One's already decided she wants to be a lawyer. The other two, we'll see. I think one's going to be pre-med, and I'm not sure, but I think that I tell medical students all the time that, you can be whatever you want if you're in a surgery residency, but it is 5 hard years. But then once you finish your training, you can go back to having some choice in what you want to do.
Well, sir, we can't thank you enough for joining us on Behind the Knife. I mean, this has just been a wonderful conversation, and we appreciate not only your thoughts on the RRC and about the Board of Surgery, but as well as in terms of your operative approaches and some of the tips and tricks. And again, thank you for your time, and we hope to have you back sometime in the future.
It's been a real honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for us today. Time for our closing count. Thank you for joining us at Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Special soul thanks to Dr. Stain for sharing with us his wisdom and experiences as it related to cystic neoplasms of the pancreas, as well as the ongoings of the RRC. Join us next time as we go behind the knife with another in-depth discussion from one of the leaders in surgery. And be sure to check out our website for the upcoming schedule.
Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions, and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Fash is closed, and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.